Today's broadcast was originally recorded on February 19th, 2024.
My message for the situation when I'm killed is very simple: not give up.
Don't give up. Message received, Mr. Navalny.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
Not to give up.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No, it ain't.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
I am. From Pacifica Radio in rainy Los Angeles, this is the Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A., 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, 93.7 in San Diego, 99.5 FM in Ridgecrest and China Lake. Also in California, in Red Bluff and Redding on KFOI, Round Mountains, KKRN. In Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's KSO, Eugene's KEPW. Lanchester, Pennsylvania's W News, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU, in Columbus, Ohio on WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP, Rochester, New York's WRFZ, down in New Orleans on WHIV, out in Gallup, Mexico on KNIZ, Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, in Seattle on KODX, Fairmont, West Virginia's AM 1700 WEFR, Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR, Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950, KTNF. We stream as well every day on the internet, so the Progressive Voices Channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, No Lies Radio, Detour Talk, and most of your favorite podcast sites. Blanketing Planet Earth, I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us for what is another, yet another rainy day out here in Southern California. And yes, we are live. This is not a rerun. It is rain yet again. Desi Doyen, another Pineapple Express.
Yes, another atmospheric river is hitting California, and nearly the entire population of the state is under flood alert. So everybody, please be careful out there. If you're in anywhere, not just in California, but anywhere with inclement weather, please be careful.
Please do. Lots of flood watches out there today, and we're already still soaked from the last Pineapple Express just a week or two ago, so be careful out there. We will get to the death of democracy hero Alexei Navalny on Friday in a little bit today, and maybe the $355 million penalty that Trump and his company and his two eldest sons were also slapped with by a New York judge on Friday in the in that state's massive fraud case against them. And maybe, if time allows, who knows, your calls at 818-985-5735 if you're in our rainy Southern California listening area or listening online via kpfk.org. But I do want to say I want to associate myself with my friend Marcy Wheeler over at Empty Wheel. She's the great national security journalist. She notes, "Happy President's Day, America. A holiday celebrating the guy who said presidents should not be kings and the guy who said insurrectionists should not be president." Just keep that in mind as we move forward today. I want to start with a different kind of fraud than the one Donald Trump was found guilty of last week. In this case, election fraud, real election fraud, or at least real evidence of real election fraud, if not yet hard proof of an actually rigged election. Now, I'm not talking about easily debunked evidence that was used to pretend that the 2020 election was stolen from Donald Trump, as he still claims to justify his embarrassing loss to Joe Biden that year, for which Trump and his supporters have been able to offer zero actual evidence. And we follow the evidence very closely on this program, as you should know if you've listened to this show or read the Brad blog for the last 20 years. Now, I will get to some new news on that part of this story shortly, but here's what actual evidence of election fraud might look like as revealed over this past weekend in Pakistan, as reported by the New York Times. A senior Pakistani official confessed on Saturday to helping manipulate the results in the country's recent elections, a startling claim strengthening a sense that the vote was among the least credible in Pakistan's history, and depending and deepening the turmoil that has seized the country ever since people went to the polls this month, just over a week ago. The official, Liaquat Ali Chatta, is a top administrative official in Punjab province, overseeing a garrison city where the military has its headquarters and three adjacent districts. He said that he would resign from his position and turn himself into the police amid national protests over the election led by the nation's jailed former prime minister amid allegations of massive fraud. At the news conference on Saturday, Chatta confessed, quote, "We converted losers into winners, reversing margins of 70,000 votes of independent candidates for 13 national parliament seats." He was referencing votes that were moved to different candidates from independent candidates who were aligned with Imran Khan, the former prime minister, whose party, the Pakistani military, had sought to sideline ahead of the recent vote. He suggested other high-ranking officials had been part of this scheme and said he was unable to sleep at night after, quote, "stabbing the country in its back." He said he actually considered suicide. Quote, "I am taking responsibility for all the wrongdoing I have committed during this election," he said at this stunning and hurriedly convened news conference in his office on Saturday. Quote, we put fake stamps on ballot papers, turning losers into winners and reversing margins of 70,000 votes at times across 13 National Assembly seats. He added, even as he had not yet offered hard evidence to back those claims, he said, "I apologize to all my returning officers who were working under my supervision and crying when I pushed them to commit a wrongful act against their free will." The election rigging allegations stem from an unprecedented nationwide suspension of mobile phone and internet services shortly before polling started on election day and a longer than usual delay in reporting results of the election. Chatta accused Pakistan's chief election commissioner and the Supreme Court justice of involvement in manipulating the elections. He sought punishment for all those responsible for the electoral fraud, including himself. He was later taken into police custody for charges that were not known immediately, according to Voice of America's coverage. The Election Commission quickly denied those charges, and the High Court's Chief Justice described the allegations as baseless without hard evidence to support the claims. The admission by Chatta came just over a week since Pakistanis went to the polls for the first time since Imran Khan had a falling out with the military, and he was ousted by the parliament back in 2022. Most had expected an easy victory for the party backed by the country's powerful military, but instead, candidates aligned with Khan won more seats in parliament than any other party, but they fell short of obtaining an outright majority, according to the reported results, which Khan's supporters charged was due to fraud due to tampering with the results of several of these independent candidates. Khan himself was not actually on the ballot. He has been imprisoned and disqualified from running for office after convictions for crimes that his supporters called trumped up against him. Yet the victory was clearly his. It was one of the biggest upsets in electoral history in Pakistan, where the military has typically engineered election results by winnowing the field of candidates using intimidation and clearing the way for its preferred party to win. The success of candidates aligned with Khan's party, known as PTI, upended that playbook and pushed the country's political scene into uncharted territory. Chatta's confession on Saturday appeared to lend weight to the accusations by the party PTI that the military had tampered with the vote count in dozens of races, particularly in the Punjab. the country's most populous province. PTI party leaders have vowed to challenge those results in court. Khan's supporters, along with members of other smaller parties, vigorously protested the results. And the PTI leaders seized on Mr. Chatta's words as vindication over the weekend, with one leader in Karachi telling a large crowd of protesters on Saturday, quote, every officer should follow him and expose the massive rigging in the polls. The protests have been a rebuke to the country's military, which conducted a months-long crackdown on the PTI before the elections to secure a reported win by the conservative Pakistan Muslim League Nawaz, or PMLN. Last week, that party, the PMLN, led by a three-time former prime minister, announced that it had cobbled together a coalition along with the country's third-largest party, the Pakistani People's Party, or the PPP, in order to lead the next government, shutting out the PTI. Chatta's claims, however, raise, quote, serious concerns about the integrity of the electoral process and the potential illegitimacy of any future government formed on the contested results. Now, adding to the criticism, the Human Rights Commission of Pakistan, the country's independent watchdog, released a scathing report on Saturday, on that same day, expressing serious concerns about the credibility and integrity of the February 8 vote. The report observed that the integrity of the elections was, quote, compromised not only by incompetence by the Election Commission, but pressure from, quote, extra-democratic quarters. That's believed to be a reference to the country's powerful military. The commission said its election observers had conducted spot checks, however, in more than 50 constituencies, and noted that, quote, the countrywide internet and cellular services shut down on polling day and arbitrary changes in polling information compromised voters' access to polling stations. The same day, the Election Commission of Pakistan, the main body that conducts polls in the country, they rejected Mr. Chatta's accusations and ordered an impartial probe into complaints that election results had been manipulated. Well, if Chatta is telling the truth about what happened, he can not only be expected to be jailed, adding, frankly, weight to his allegations, but there should be many others who can corroborate his claims. So contrast those allegations with the endless, evidence-free claims in this country, requiring, counting on, among other things, unnamed whistleblowers and unnamed informants that Trump's minions claimed existed after the 2020 election here in the U.S., all of those so-called unnamed whistleblowers and informants have completely fallen apart, or we have since learned they never actually existed in the first place. Now, we told you a week or so ago on this program about the clearly legally mandated tweet that was published by the disgraced Republican dirty trickster and pretend journalist named James O'Keefe at the beginning of the month, admitting that his reporting on 2020 election fraud in Pennsylvania was, quote, wrong, and that he is, quote, aware of no evidence of other allegations that election fraud occurred in the Erie, Pennsylvania post office during the 2020 presidential election, as James O'Keefe and his so-called Project Veritas had falsely reported following the 2020 election.
And what? It only took almost four years to get that?
It only took almost 4 years. And a demand in a legal suit that he better do it if he wants to settle that suit. His tweet included an official statement from a postal worker in Erie, Pennsylvania, who O'Keefe had publicized after the 2020 election, falsely claiming that he had overheard someone claiming to have overheard someone that they were backdating vote-by-mail ballots so that they would be counted at the Erie post office. The claims of that supposed USPS whistleblower, who had spawned hundreds of thousands of false claims by Trump supporters and right-wing propaganda outlets that the election was stolen, That guy says in the statement that James O'Keefe was obliged apparently to include in his tweet that he, quote, was wrong, that there was no, quote, inappropriate behavior concerning the 2020 presidential election, and that he knew of no other USPS employee who, quote, engaged in election fraud or any other wrongdoing related to mail-in ballots. Yes, it took us 4 years to get to that point. Of course, if you listen to this program, we told you that point as it happened. Anyway, that was all nearly 4 years after he was O'Keefe was the first to make that false claim, and he only admitted it, you know, even if he didn't use those words in his statement that he was wrong himself, that the claims were false. He only admitted it when his reporting was wrong, when he knew that there was no other evidence of allegations of wrongdoing, and he would be sued if he did not admit it. And yet, when Donald Trump was yet again sort of mildly challenged last year on CNN about his 100% phony and or debunked and or evidence-free claims that the 2020 election was stolen from him last year, he said, quote, well, if you look at True the Vote, they found millions of votes on camera, on government cameras. They were stuffing ballot boxes. He said that just last year. The fact is, nope, they didn't. They didn't find millions of votes. They weren't on cameras. There is no evidence of stuffing ballot boxes. He was referring to a film called 2000 Mules, a supposed documentary film highlighting claims of massive absentee ballot fraud in half a dozen or more swing states on behalf of Democrats. It's a film made by a guy who, ironically enough, the director, he was actually convicted of actual election fraud himself in years past, but he was pardoned by, guess who? Donald Trump, before he left office. And while I've, you know, devoted too many programs probably to 2000 Mules, and its many completely debunked claims, it looks like we're going to have to spend at least a few more minutes on it here now. Now that the last of its claims last week have utterly fallen apart. As Washington Post's Philip Bump reported last week, since Donald Trump left office in January 2021, there has been no more influential presentation of his theory that the election was stolen than the film 2000 Mules, created by activist and Trump pardon recipient Dinesh D'Souza. In fact, D'Souza pleaded guilty to federal election fraud charges some years ago. So the guy is a known fraudster. Anyway, as Bump reports it, D'Souza's movie was a masterpiece of meeting market demand. There was a nationwide scramble by red hat-wearing enthusiasts to prove that Joe Biden cheated his way into the White House, a rush for evidence that made mini celebrities of people like MyPillow CEO Mike Lindell. And into this bedlam strode D'Souza. He held in his hand data that was cobbled together by a right-wing activist group called True the Vote, a group out of Texas with its own long and well-documented history of fraudulent claims about so-called Democratic election fraud, which they have never been able to share evidence of. And he claimed that this data in this movie, 2000 Mules, showed thousands of people collecting and submitting fraudulent ballots at drop boxes in swing states. The only problem, of course, as Bump correctly notes, was that it was all nonsense. It was immediately apparent nonsense, certainly, and not only because a national ring of thousands of people who have had to somehow go completely undetected, but because even after the movie came out, the alleged caper yielded zero arrests. It was also obviously nonsense because True the Vote's data could not do what the group claimed it did. Back in 2021, True the Vote had contacted the Georgia Bureau of Investigation, the GBI, about its allegations. Specifically, the organization claimed to have cell phone geolocation evidence showing that hundreds of people had traveled to multiple ballot drop boxes over and over again on given days. This, the group had insisted, proved that there was an operation focused on depositing ballots into those drop boxes, something that it claimed was bolstered by a whistleblower who admitted to being a part of that operation. A whistleblower. But by September of 2021, even before the film was released, as we reported on this show, the Georgia Bureau of Investigations had rejected that claim, in part because True the Vote declined to put investigators in contact with this so-called whistleblower. That notwithstanding, the data collected by True the Vote, using not GPS data, as some have claimed, but less precise cell tower positioning, well, the data showed nothing more than people traveling within 100 feet of Dropbox locations at various times. That's it. So if you happen to pass by one of those Dropboxes on your way to and from work each day, well, congratulations. You were a 2020 Democratic ballot mule for the Democratic Party. If you were a postal worker on your route going, you know, within 100 feet of a Dropbox to deliver mail each day, well, you were a ballot mule. Anyway, the entire thing was nonsense, but it was huge. And frankly, it still is. In MAGA circles, where they, you know, actually believe that the film shows any evidence of any fraudulent ballot cast in the 2020 election. It doesn't. But facts and evidence do not appear to matter to those folks. Hopefully, it matters to our audience. But as Bump notes, it did not end with the GBI rejecting the data as nonsense. Georgia officials, who had been under relentless attack following the 2020 election, demanded that True the Vote turn over whatever evidence or information about informants that they had. They eventually obtained a court order for the group to do so, and last week the group's attorneys responded. Their response? They had no such evidence to share. As AP reported it last week, True the Vote filed complaints with Georgia, including one in which it had said it had obtained a, quote, detailed account of coordinated efforts to collect and deposit ballots in drop boxes across metro Atlanta during the November 2020 election and a January 2021 runoff for U.S. Senate. A Fulton County Superior Court judge in Atlanta signed an order last year requiring True the Vote provide evidence that it had collected, including the names of people who were the sources of that information to state election officials. You know, those whistleblowers. In their response, their written response, the attorneys said the group had no names or any other documentary evidence to share. It was all nonsense. A state election board investigation found that surveillance camera footage that the film claimed to show ballot stuffing actually showed people submitting ballots for themselves and for their family members who lived with them, which is perfectly allowable under Georgia law. The election board subpoenaed True the Vote to provide evidence that would assist it in investigating the group's ballot trafficking claims. After all, they claimed in their film and across right-wing media after its release that they had the specific cell phone location data for these people going from the Democratic Party offices to the drop boxes over and over again. Of course, since Georgia has cameras on their drop boxes, one would think it would be easy to match up the footage in those security cameras to that cell phone data. The group had obtained the footage via open records requests. And it seems like they'd be able to show the people repeatedly dropping by the drop boxes to cast these fraudulent votes, matching up with the cell phone data. And yet, the footage in the film, not that anyone from MAGA bothered to notice, but the footage in the film shows nobody repeatedly visiting any drop box, which I guess the dupes who watched the film and claimed it showed evidence of fraud just did not happen to notice. Nonetheless, the groups still had that ace in the hole, didn't they? That supposed whistleblower who was a part of the scheme. Truth the Vote's complaint to the election board said they, quote, spoke with several individuals regarding personal knowledge, methods, and organizations involved in ballot trafficking in Georgia. It said one person referred to in the complaint only as John Doe, quote, admitted to personally participating and provided specific information about the ballot trafficking process. That sounds very bad, and yet they refused to turn over information on John Doe for years, or these other supposed several individuals with, quote, personal knowledge of the scheme. And that led Georgia officials who were frustrated by the group's refusal to share the supposed evidence. It led them to go to court last year against True the Vote to force them to turn over the names and the contact information for anyone who had provided information, as well as any recordings or transcripts or witness statements or other documents supporting its allegations. And as we now know, according to the group's legal response written in December, according to the Atlanta Journal-Constitution last week, the group came up empty-handed, despite having, quote, made every additional reasonable effort to locate responsive items. True the Vote has a long disgraced founder and president by the name of Catherine Engelbrecht. She didn't respond immediately to all of these reports seeking comment last week. She and another member of the group were briefly jailed in 2022 for contempt for not complying with the court order to provide information in a defamation lawsuit. Now we know why. Now we know why they couldn't provide that information. They had none. They tend to just sort of make things up over there at True the Vote. And yet, like the disgraced James O'Keefe, they are still treated as legitimate sources in the right-wing media sphere. We still have listeners on this program who call in from time to time, citing 2,000 mules as evidence that the 2020 election was stolen. That suit that resulted in Engelbrecht's jailing for a time had to do with the group falsely claiming that an election software provider had stored personal information on U.S. election workers on an unsecured server in China. Just another fake claim following the 2020 election. But the Georgia State Election Board apparently refused to let the complaint go. They went to court, tried to force them to turn over the information, and the group's attorney replied, quote, True the Vote has no such documents in its possession, custody, or control. In other words, they made it all up. Or they destroyed any such evidence. I'm going to go with option A there, but that's just me. Georgia, of course, was not the only state to call out True the Vote. The Post-Philip Bump notes that officials in Arizona recommended the group be investigated by the FBI and the IRS due to its tax-exempt status for failing to provide the evidence it claimed it had about ballot stuffing in Arizona. True the Vote itself promised for months that it would release its data publicly to validate the claims made in 2,000 mules, and as we have previously reported, they never did, ultimately admitting on camera that they had no such evidence. When they began facing pressure from these various states to produce their evidence, they claimed that, you know, Chinese hackers had erased the data on their hard drives. Now, Catherine Engelbrecht, the director and longtime chief grifter over there at True the Vote, was often joined when appearing in the media after the film was released with a guy named Greg Phillips, her partner in this scam. Again, the disgraced former president continues to cite this to this day. But Phillips, he had already burned his credibility, Greg Phillips, after the 2016 election. He claimed at the time that he had found millions of fraudulent votes, but he was never able to produce any, you know, evidence of it. Nonetheless, it didn't stop Donald Trump from citing that claim either. But during a right-wing forum just before the 2022 midterms, and yes, I am working hard to put this story to bed, during a right-wing forum just before the 2022 midterms, As pressure was building for this pair, Engelbrecht and Phillips, to produce the evidence to actually support the claims made by them and D'Souza in this film, in August of 2022, Engelbrecht and Phillips simply declared at this right-wing forum that, you know what, they were done with 2,000 Mules. Don't ask them anymore about it.
The end of Mules, we're
the
done.
The end of Mules, end scene, we're done. And honestly, guys, and I know, don't hold your applause for one more second.
For what? Applause
it's
for what?
It's time to move on. Not to move on to what happened in 2020, because we still have to understand what happened. That is critical. We have to understand that. But we are 90-some days out from 2020. Sorry?
88.
Oh, we're 88 days out from midterms. And we have to find that balance. You have to understand the past is prologue. We have to understand what happened. But we also have to be positioned to move forward. And so thank you. So.
Yeah, let's move forward. Let's not worry about the blockbuster claims that we just released as a motion picture into theaters all over the country. Let's move forward from that. We don't have time. We've got another election coming up in just, a few months. A film which its director, the election fraudster Dinesh D'Souza, as Philip Bump notes, claims to be entirely dependent on True the Vote's data. And the supposed insider informants and the whistleblowers who True the Vote now admit they have no information about, which makes it sort of seem like they never actually existed. Bump notes that he asked D'Souza back in 2022 a question about one of the whistleblower claims that he makes in the movie. And D'Souza replied, quote, I don't know that because I haven't talked to the whistleblower. The filmmaker didn't talk to the whistleblower himself. D'Souza told Bump at the time, quote, the whistleblower spoke to True the Vote investigators. So I have to admit that my information from that comes from True the Vote. That's the information that True the Vote now admits that it does not have. Also at that forum, and I don't have time to play it, but they admitted that the videos that they have, as Greg Phillips described them, are junk. The video is junk. You can't see anything in them, he said, and that's another reason why they're moving on. Because I guess they're junk. The local jurisdictions who set up security cameras on their drop boxes, well, those videos, the ones they made a feature-length documentary about claiming that a presidential election was stolen by them. You didn't do a good enough job, Greg. It wasn't the videos. It was you and your fellow election fraud fraudsters didn't do a good job. It was you. In fact, you failed. Not that that's going to keep the right-wing media from going back to you, Greg Phillips, and you, Catherine Engelbrecht, and you, Dinesh D'Souza, and you, James O'Keefe, all of you liars, for whatever it is going to be your next false claims. Because those people, while they might want to move on from their last false claims, they will never move on from that grift. Because that's how they live. Quick break, and we're back with some thoughts on a real democracy fighter. Right after this, I'm Brad Friedman. You're listening to the Bradcast.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. Election security experts warned the country's secretaries of state to take immediate steps to harden their election systems in both cities and rural precincts and to prepare for cyber and AI election interference from both foreign and domestic bad actors. Stateline News reports that representatives from the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, or CISA, and the Criminal Cyber Response and Services Branch of the FBI FBI, spoke at the winter meetings of the National Associations of Secretaries of State and State Election Directors. Attendees were warned of a heightened risk of election interference using cyber attacks from U.S. adversaries, including Russia, China, Iran, and North Korea. This includes a possibility of attacks on election and other infrastructure, including ransomware attacks. Fulton County, Georgia, experienced such an attack in early January. CISA announced a new webpage last week called Protect 2024, making recommendations to states and municipalities on hardening infrastructure. Concerns were also raised about AI, which could make it easier to trick voters with misinformation, such as the fake Biden robocall in New Hampshire, or targeting legal immigrant citizens in their languages. All this in addition to continued threats of violence to election officials from homegrown domestic extremists. We have links to the Stateline news article at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. I'm Brian Beal. Find us on Facebook at American Democracy Minute.
Hey, it's Brad. Well, here we are in another critical presidential election year. We cover elections like no other outlet in the nation, with a specific focus on the track conditions as opposed to only the horse race, though we do cover that too. This election year will be a big one, like none other. It could even be the last one, depending on how it goes. Seriously. So, if you've come to rely on the broadcast for critical coverage in election years, please consider supporting our work with a generous donation via bradblog.com/donate. Help keep the broadcast and bradblog.com free for all. A one-time donation, or better yet, a simple automated subscription, is greatly appreciated and very much needed. We could not do any of this without you. Please stop by bradblog.com/donate right now. And from both Desi and me, thank you.
You're listening to an encore presentation of the Bradcast.
Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. This part of the story alone is frankly troubling to me. AP's story following last week's death of imprisoned Kremlin opponent and Democratic hero Alexei Navalny is bylined by the Associated Press. Now, normally, unless it's just a very quick stub of a breaking news story, they'll include the journalist's name in the byline, the journalist or the journalists. Not today. This story is simply credited to the Associated Press, as if they have good reason not to name the journalist or the journalists in Russia or elsewhere who are responsible for the story. So tell me again, Tucker Carlson, how Vladimir Putin is such a wonderful guy and Russia right now is such a wonderful place. Looks like you picked a pretty crappy time to go to Russia to sit down for 2 hours with Vladimir Putin, not ask him once about Alexei Navalny, and then to run around and talk about what a wonderful place it is, how much greater Russia is than these terrible United States. In any event, according to the Associated Press today, according to someone at the Associated Press, the widow of Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny vowed on Monday to continue his fight against the Kremlin, while authorities denied his own mother access to a morgue where his body is believed to be held after his death last week in the Arctic penal colony. With her voice cracking at times in a video posted on social media, Yulia Navalnaya accused Russian President Vladimir Putin of killing her husband in the remote prison and alleged that officials' refusal to hand over the body to her mother-in-law was part of a cover-up. Russian authorities said that the cause of Navalny's death on Friday at age 47 is, well, it's still unknown. Many Western leaders have already said that they hold Putin responsible for the death, including President Biden, who offered remarks following the news on Friday.
Make no mistake, Putin is responsible for Navalny's death. Putin is responsible. What has happened in Navalny is yet more proof of Putin's brutality. No one should be fooled, not in Russia, not at home, not anywhere in the world. Putin does not only target his citizens of other countries, as we've seen what's going on in Ukraine right now. He also inflicts terrible crimes on his own people. And as people across Russia and around the world are mourning Navalny today, because he was so many things that Putin was not. He was brave. He was principled. He was dedicated to building a Russia where the rule of law existed and where it applied to everybody. Navalny believed in that Russia, that Russia. He knew it was a cause worth fighting for and obviously even dying for.
Terrible crimes against his own people is actually a very nice way to put it, Mr. President. Navalny's death has deprived the Russian opposition of its most well-known and inspiring politician less than 1 month before an election that is all but certain to give Putin another 6 years in power, because there are no opposition names on that ballot. It dealt a devastating blow to many Russians who had seen Navalny as a rare hope for political change amid Putin's unrelenting crackdown on the opposition. Navalny had been in prison since January of 2021 when he returned to Moscow, incredibly enough, after recuperating in Germany from a nerve agent poisoning that he had blamed on the Kremlin. In fact, in the extraordinary 2022 documentary called Navalny, which, by the way, if you haven't seen it by now, I cannot recommend more highly that you watch it. It's available on Max and Amazon Prime and elsewhere.
It's amazing. It's a really beautifully done, very impactful documentary.
That's a nice way to put it. As I noted on this program, after I had finally saw it, I think last year, I was blown away by it. It includes the amazing moment when Navalny himself actually gets one of his own attempted assassins to admit how he tried to assassinate him and that it was done on behalf of the Kremlin. They show that happening live. They show Navalny's confrontation with this guy live, and it is amazing. But even after that, he returned to Russia. He was immediately then taken into custody. He was given trumped up charges, sentenced to about 19 years, but he would die just one day after appearing in court last week when he appeared, yes, gaunt, but smiling, certainly not on the verge of death. His wife, Yulia, noted in her comments today, quote, "They are cowardly and meanly hiding his body, refusing to give it to his mother and lying miserably while waiting for the trace of poison to disappear," suggesting that her husband might have been killed this time successfully with the Novichok-style nerve agent, which was the nerve agent that they used against him unsuccessfully before. She urged Russians to rally behind her, quote, "to share not only the grief and endless pain that has enveloped and gripped us, but also my rage," she said. She continued, "The main thing that we can do for Alexei and ourselves is to keep fighting. We all need to get together in one strong fist and strike that mad regime." She said it, of course, in Russian, so I'm reading you the translation. On Monday, the director of Navalny's Anti-Corruption Foundation said that his body would not be given to his mother for 14 days while a chemical examination takes place, according to a Russian investigator. Navalny's death took his supporters by surprise on Friday, as made clear in these remarks by a Russian journalist now living in exile here in the U.S., Mikhail Zeiger, remarks that appear to have taken MSNBC's Chris Hayes off guard, as he had sort of presumed that many in Russia had sort of assumed that Navalny would someday die in prison.
I imagine you and people like you in your circle, people that have been opposed to Putin, Russian exiles and even people within Russia, have been anticipating this moment.
No.
No.
No. You know, it's it's weird, but as we used to think that he's not an ordinary human being.
Navalny.
I remember that back in 2015, I published the book, All the Kremlin's Men, and one of the chapters was about Navalny. And I started that chapter saying that he's not an ordinary human being. He's an alien. He's supernatural. He has always been so sure that his destiny was to fight against the regime. And everyone seemed to consider him to be the person doomed to be the next president of Russia. He had to be Russia's first real George Washington. He had to be Russia's first democratically elected leader and the leader who wanted Russia to be a democracy. And we have always considered to be the next ideal president of Russia. He was the symbol of the possibility of that decent democratic future. At least we have the moral example. At least we have probably the first real democratic superhero in Russian history, because Russian history is very traumatic. It's very imperialist. We have a huge history of violence, and not a history of prominent human rights defenders. So I think that the person who could have become our George Washington, sadly, has become our Martin Luther King. But he is going to be our moral example, and he's going to be the person who has led us, who has shown the way. And he has always believed in human rights, in free speech, in the possibility of fair justice. And he was the person who spent years trying to defend that righteous cause. And I think that it's very important, because he is going to be the hero for the generations to come, for the generations of Russians.
The person who could have become Russia's George Washington has become their Martin Luther King. An appropriate comment, I suppose, this week for with President's Day.
Yeah, appropriate and heartbreaking.
Their moral example, the man who still he, Mikhail Zygar there insists will show Russia the way to be the hero for generations of Russians. So we can only hope so, as that nation reels under the autocratic, deadly hand of Vladimir Putin, who has arrested hundreds of protesters following the death of Navalny. Just the latest of those killed in Russia for daring to oppose Putin's rule. A man who has launched what will be this week a 2-year imperialistic invasion of its peaceful, non-threatening sovereign neighbor in Ukraine. And remarkably, Putin is a man who is now idolized by what used to be the Republican Party in the U.S. and by its now cult leader, Donald Trump. And it's not just folks on the right. We hear it all the time from folks on the far left who have fallen for the same right-wing propaganda that those on the right have fallen for. That somehow this isn't Vladimir Putin's fault. Somehow this is Joe Biden's fault. This is NATO's fault. This is Ukraine's fault. And that's what Donald Trump is going along with. Days passed before Donald Trump said one word about the death of Navalny at the hands of Trump's friend, Vladimir Putin. More than 72 hours after Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny's death in an Arctic penal colony, former President Donald Trump finally mentioned him by name for the first time on Monday, reports Jill Colvin of AP. She was allowed to put her name on this story. I guess she's not in Russia. Former President Donald Trump finally mentioned him by name for the first time on Monday in a post on his social media site that focused, you'll be shocked, not on Navalny, but on Donald Trump's own legal woes. Trump made no mention of Vladimir Putin or of Navalny's family
in the Post on Monday morning that instead cast himself as a victim and continued to paint the U.S. as a nation in decline. Quote, "The sudden death of Alexei Navalny has made me more and more aware of what is happening in our country," he wrote. "It is a slow, steady progression with crooked, radical left politicians, prosecutors, and judges leading us down a path to destruction, open borders, rigged election, and grossly unfair courtroom decisions are destroying America. We are a nation in decline," all caps, "a failing nation, MAGA 2024. That was the official statement of the former president of the United States on the death in prison of top Kremlin opponent and would-be someday president of the nation, Alexei Navalny. "We are a nation in decline, MAGA 2024. I suppose there's a reason that he didn't say something more, like lifelong Republican Liz Cheney said in this statement.
You know, when you think about Donald Trump, for example, pledging retribution, what Vladimir Putin did to Navalny is what retribution looks like in a country where the leader is not subject to the rule of law. And I think that we have to take Donald Trump very seriously. We have to take seriously the extent to which, you know, you've now got a Putin wing of the Republican Party. I believe the issue this election cycle is making sure the Putin wing of the Republican Party does not take over the West Wing of the White House.
Yeah, well, that Putin wing of the Republican Party is pretty much the whole Republican Party at this point. A New York judge on Friday ordered Donald Trump to pay $355 million in penalties in a civil fraud trial, finding the former president had inflated his wealth for years, scheming to dupe banks and insurers and others. He was recently found by two different juries to have raped and defamed journalist E. Jean Carroll. He was ordered to pay more than $80 million in penalties to her. And, of course, he has been criminally charged in four separate investigations, the first of which is scheduled to go to trial next month on March 25. And I could go on for quite a while about all of that, but it's only an hour-long show. Yes, Donald Trump would indeed like to see some retribution for his crimes, which, by the way, is the only reason that he is running for president this year, in hopes of getting that retribution, just like Vladimir Putin got against his purported enemies, which, like Putin's, is now a very long list. Biden's campaign, Joe Biden's campaign, posted on Twitter that after days of silence, Trump finally responded by comparing Navalny to himself in a, quote, deranged social media post. And yes, I think that's a good way to put it, a deranged social media post. The sudden death of Alexei Navalny led him to believe how crooked everyone is in our own country and how we're a failing nation and how he must be elected as the next president. Because Putin killed Navalny? Really? Also, by the way, Trump's reference there to Navalny's, quote, sudden death, that was notable as well, as some observed. Prison officials allegedly told Navalny's mother when she arrived at the penal colony on Saturday that her son had perished from, quote, sudden death syndrome. Oh, sudden death syndrome. That, according to the head of Navalny's Anti-Corruption Foundation. So even in his remarks, his few words on Navalny's tragic, stunning death, Donald Trump was citing Vladimir Putin's propaganda for how Navalny died. Sudden death. Oh, it was sudden death syndrome. Sure. In the Oscar-winning documentary film, Navalny, which, again, if you haven't seen it, you will thank me. In that film, the filmmakers asked the dissident as he was recuperating in Germany after they tried to assassinate him with poison. As he was recuperating in Germany before ultimately returning to Russia to then be immediately arrested and ultimately killed, the filmmakers asked how he wished to be remembered if he died.
My message for the situation when I am killed is very simple. Not give up.
Do me a favor. Answer this one in Russian.
И здесь у меня просто очевидная вещь. Ну, не сдавайтесь. Не надо, нельзя сдаваться. Если это произошло, это означает, что мы...
He says, my message is very simple. Don't give up. The interviewer asked him to respond in Russian, and Navalny said, listen, I've got something very obvious to tell you. You're not allowed to give up. If they decide to kill me, it means that we are incredibly strong. We need to utilize this power, he said, to not give up, to remember we are a huge power that is being oppressed by these bad dudes. We don't realize how strong we actually are, said Navalny, adding the only thing necessary for the triumph of evil is for good people to do nothing. So don't be inactive. I think that's a good message for all of us to take away. Also, don't be fooled by liars and con men and grifters and propagandists. Frankly, whether they come at you from the right or the left. And for God's sakes, don't be inactive. We got to get out. My thanks to our producer, Desi Doyen, to our board operator today, Wendell Handy, and to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's program or any other, you can download it anytime for free at bradblog.com, where we have for 20 years made everything we do available for free and for your scrutiny, bradblog.com. Drop me an email if you like. I am bradcast@bradblog.com. On the Facebooks, Mastodons, and sites still known as Twitter, you will find me at TheBradBlog. Did I mention you can drop me an email? I am bradcast@bradblog.com. Always good to hear from you. That's it. We will see you at all of the above until we see you here, hopefully tomorrow, if we don't get flooded away. I'm Brad Friedman. This is the Bradcast. Good luck, world.
To the Bradcast. We are 100% listener supported, thanks to listeners like you who drop by bradblog.com/donate.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1910. That was the day streetcar workers in Philadelphia walked off the job just as garment workers were ending their victorious strike. The walkout soon turned into a general strike. The Amalgamated Association of Street and Electrical Railway Employees, Local 477, had been trying to negotiate fewer hours, higher wages, and union recognition for almost a year. Philadelphia Rapid Transit broke off negotiations in mid-February, fired 173 union members, and imported scab replacements from New York City. The Amalgamated Association of Street and Electric Railway Employees called workers out. Strikers pulled apart buildings under construction and used the materials to block tracks and build strike shelters. Many trolley cars were badly damaged when the Philadelphia Rapid Transit attempted to resume service. Scab drivers fared as badly as the trains they attempted to run. the mayor called for citizens to serve police duty after strikers loaded dynamite onto tracks in Germantown. The union offered up its members to preserve order, but the mayor refused. Then the Philadelphia Rapid Transit brought in an additional 600 scabs and National Guardsmen to protect them. Area workers were infuriated at this latest move, as were small businesses and religious groups. On March 5th, the Central Federated Union called a general strike. More than 75,000 workers stayed off the job to protest anti-worker assaults. Though the general strike was called off at the end of March, transit workers stayed out until April 19th. They won wage increases, rehiring of strikers, and mediation for the initial 173 fired workers. They could not secure exclusive union recognition, but the strike solidified solidarity among area workers and demonstrated the capacity of labor to organize work actions across industrial lines.